Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's influence in Congress could be dwindling. That is, if population projections hold true for the 2020 census. The Buckeye State is likely to lose one of its 16 congressional seats. Neighboring Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Michigan are also on pace to lose seats after this year's national headcount. We're talking about that and more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Laura Bischoff, state government reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Welcome back.
Happy 2020, everyone.
Andy Chow, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Happy New Year, Ann.
Happy 2020. It's our first. We haven't been around. The roundtable has not been gathered for something like 3 weeks now. So
yeah, since last year.
Since last year. So
some would say last decade.
Yeah. It feels like forever to me.
So welcome to the Roaring 20s with Ann Fisher.
Right. It's the 20s. But that also means there's a new census coming out. Mm-hmm. And Ohio's not looking good. I mean, we kind of maybe get a little inured to it here in Columbus because the population keeps growing and is expected to. But that barely offsets loss in other parts of the state. I thought we had 18 members in Congress, but
16. We have 18 electoral votes because you count the two senators.
So I was reading
16,
that going,
wow. Yeah. And frankly, people have been expecting this for years and years.
Right. It's not a surprise.
Yeah. And it's not that Ohio's losing people. We're just not gaining people nearly as quickly as some other regions. So, yeah, Ohio's due to go to 16 down to 15, if the current projections. And some of the usual suspects. You mentioned the other Rust Belt, dare we say, Midwest
Pennsylvania,
states.
Michigan.
Yeah, also losing, which would be expected. But California is also losing one. But places like Texas, I think they're getting like three more. Again, this is all current projections, not official yet, but we're pretty close to the actual census taking place. So
just to remind listeners about what happens when the lines are drawn or redrawn, as the case may be. It's the apportionment board. It's the state auditor, right, Andy? Secretary of State.
Auditor, Secretary of State, members
Attorney
of
General?
The General Assembly. No. We're talking about
governor, auditor, and secretary of state.
Those are the statewide office holders, and then a couple members from the Ohio General Assembly.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
That's apportionment board, but then the maps are drawn and must be
approved
by the General Assembly at some point.
Well, we have a new process really this year.
That's right.
This is what Ohio voters first voted to amend how we redraw legislative maps. And then a couple years later, that seemed to be very popular. Now we're going to do it with congressional. So I'm sure Andy and Laura, like me, are on all these mailing lists it's redistricting year. We got to reform, Ohio actually has reformed, at least it's on paper. So this is going to be a key year. Well, it's actually next year. It's probably going to be the key year. Mm-hmm. The actual census will take place this year. And then new districts will be drawn for the 2022 elections. Of course, nothing happens for 2020. This will be the last election under the current setup, if you will, and with the current numbers. We'll still elect 16 members of Congress in 2020. 2022, when everything will take effect. So that interim year, 2021, it's going to be interesting. There were a lot of promises made. We were taking the partisanship out of it. I don't know all the details, but basically supermajorities are required to approve new legislative maps, new congressional maps. But it's far from a controversy-free process.
Already the Democrats are vastly outnumbered by Republicans in the congressional delegation. Right, Laura?
Right, it's 12-4.
Yeah.
It's a 12-4 right now. And the question is, when we go from 16 to 15 is, who's going to get voted off the island?
Right, kind of like musical chairs.
Musical chairs. Yep. There could be an argument, like the Republicans are in charge. Maybe they cut out another Democratic seat, but that would be maybe seen as kind of greedy. So maybe they'll eliminate a Republican seat, or I don't know. I mean, the map's going to get totally redrawn. Right now we have these, kind of kooky-shaped district maps that everybody has pointed to as evidence of extreme gerrymandering, and this new Daryl's right. This new process is going to be in place, and it's kind of TBD on whether or not it's going to actually take the extreme partisanship out of what is an inherently partisan process.
Yeah, it's a political process.
Yeah, and so when we're talking about redistricting, like Laura said, we're talking about if we're making it more of a Republican-friendly district or maybe a Democrat-Republic-friendly district. But then what the new rules that are in place, so not just the process but the rules around the process, are also supposed to, you know, in, you know, the argument is that they're supposed to make it a
more competitive
district, where right now what we're seeing in many or most districts is that the big competition happens in the primary, where one party, where you try to either go further to the right or further to the left to win your primary, and then you don't face much competition in the general election. And so there are rules in place to try to make sure that doesn't happen as much anymore as well, like county splitting, not to split up the county too many times. No county splitting for most of Ohio's 88 counties. And then for the bigger, more populous counties, only splitting it once or twice.
You know, and I remember there was a lot of people that were, you know, jumping on board endorsing it. But the ACLU of Ohio did not endorse it because they just weren't confident that it was going to remove the, you know, the partisanship, that it was going to actually work. So it really is a matter of, you know, see how it goes.
Okay, we'll see how it goes. We'll know by probably 2021 what the score is.
Mm-hmm.
But
right,
we'll
yeah.
know about the population numbers, but nobody expects that to differ drastically from the projections.
Yeah, I don't think so. And, I mean, Laura's right. It's like, and can you even draw maps in Ohio where a Republican majority would say, go for 13-3. Can you draw them so there are only three Democratic areas in Ohio? I mean, part of the concerns raised about the current 12-4 Republican majority in Congress is that is not reflective of Ohio, of how Ohioans have voted statewide in terms of D versus R. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the claims, hey, this is unfair. You know, Democrats are not just, you know, 1/4 of Ohio's population or vote or anything like that. So we'll see. And again, while Republicans have the upper hand, it's supposed to be require minority party participation. One of the interesting dynamics, and I guess it's kind of a sensitive subject, you know, last time around, one of the biggest threats to these is a civil rights lawsuit discriminating against minority representatives. We have I think Marcia Fudge's district is still majority minority up in Cuyahoga County, but they really had to do some maneuvers with that. That district comes down I-77 into Akron just to get African-American communities, neighborhoods, just to make that come out.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Columbus, Joyce Beatty's third congressional district, it is substantially African-American, not majority, but certainly she's been a four-term incumbent now in that district. So what happened the last time around, as I recall, the majority Republicans say, hey, we've got this really nice Republican map, and yeah, it favors Republicans, but look what you can get out of a black caucus. You can get, okay, four Democratic Congress members of Congress, but two of them would be African-American. And as many of them signed off on that. They made that trade. And frankly, there's a little bit of tension within the Democratic Party. But that's why you saw no litigation right afterwards, because, hey, it was approved with Democratic African-American votes within the legislature. So will something similar happen this time around? Again, with that minority party participation, could, you know, black lawmakers will have that choice. Do I help my party, you know, or do I want more minority representation in Congress, which has been underrepresented, you know, in terms of African Americans for, well, forever in America.
Mm-hmm. What, just again, catching up and going back to some issues that emerged over the past year and what happened and what's happening, the 6-week abortion ban was signed into law all the way back in April now, with no exceptions for rape or incest. The law has stalled in federal court. What happens next?
On the fetal heartbeat abortion ban bill that's still being challenged. Meanwhile, there's movement in the legislature to, you know, go with an absolute ban.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Sabrina Eaton from The Plain Dealer had a story about how nearly every Republican member of Congress signed on to a legal brief that urges the U.S. Supreme Court to use this case out of Louisiana, which has a law similar to one in Ohio that requires doctors at clinics to have admitting privileges with nearby hospitals. And so there's some push to make that the law that challenge, or that the case that
outright bans it,
causes the Supreme Court to reconsider and even overturn Roe versus Wade. And there's another case also, the Pennsylvania Planned Parenthood of Pennsylvania versus Casey, which is also an abortion rights ruling. So, you know, I think that there's I think the right to life side of things is really kind of continuing to push for an outright a ban.
Is there anything notable about who didn't sign on to that letter?
Well, you know, in Ohio, it was, the Democrats didn't sign on.
None.
And I think Rob Portman signed on. Mm-hmm. Steve Stivers did not sign on, okay. And neither did Dave Joyce, but I'm not entirely clear why.
Okay. The August 4 mass shooting in Dayton, and likewise that weekend in El Paso, Texas, have not seen much movement when it comes to restricting gun ownership in the state of Ohio. The crowd in Dayton, you know, at the first kind of public event afterward shouted, "Do something." Is the Ohio General Assembly doing anything, Andy?
I guess it depends on what you mean by doing something, because they are holding hearings on certain pieces of legislation. But I think a lot of people who do want to see something happen would say it's not enough at this point. You know, a lot's been made of how the General Assembly, when they want to, can pass things pretty quickly. And when it comes to, like you said, this happened in August. 2 days later, Governor DeWine said that he wanted to put a piece of legislation out there that would reduce gun violence. 2 months later, an actual bill was introduced. And then several months after that, where we are now is that bill is still sitting in the Senate committee of which it was introduced. So at this point, it's just kind of moving very slowly. Now, Governor DeWine has said that this is going to be his top priority this year legislatively, is to get this thing passed. And just to remind people, he calls it the Strong Ohio Plan, which sort of expands the ability for courts to put people into mental health treatment. Not necessarily. So instead of confiscating guns, which is what more of the red flag law would be, it would put the person in question who's deemed to be a threat to themselves or others into mental health treatment. And then it sort of does some things with background checks, but stops short of actually requiring background checks for personal transfers. But the governor believes that this is what can be done that could reduce gun violence, but also has a chance of passing the legislature. And again, that's stuck in the Senate right now. And the House leaders, Republican House leaders, have signaled that there's not a lot of willingness to work on this bill at this point.
And the same with Senate President Larry Aboff. You know, they question the constitutionality still of some of those provisions. So we have this bill that the governor's proposal is being carried by Senator Matt Dolan from up in the Cleveland area. The Democrats saying this is way too tepid, doesn't go nearly far enough, but it's the best we got. So and for the most part, they'll begrudgingly will support it. You got Republicans say even that thing that you regard as tepid, we regard as going too far and infringing upon Second Amendment rights. Governor DeWine still insists he's going to get this through. And he's right. One of the criteria, and Governor DeWine said this right from the gate, it's not necessarily proposing the ideal solution or whatever, but it's something that will combat the problem and be able to be passed. Now, so it's that last thing that's going to be defined here in 2020 and in coming months. At the same time, we have the Stand Your Ground bill, which would expand gun rights, remove the duty to retreat or attempt to retreat, if you can do so safely, mm-hmm. when confronted by someone trying to do you violence. Governor DeWine supports that, but he did say in maybe his year-end interviews that put that a hold. I'm not even going to talk about that till you pass my strong Ohio proposal
and
first.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, they're gathering signatures, or they're going to, or they've put it off.
Still gathering signatures. So the idea was that there's could potentially be a ballot issue on this November's ballot that would create basically universal background checks. So right now, it's possible to buy a gun without getting a background check at a gun show or personal through online transfers, personal transfers. There was a group, Ohioans for Gun Safety, that wanted to potentially put it on the ballot this year. Last month, they announced that they weren't able to collect enough signatures, the signatures that they needed. And they were looking at November 2020, looking at a busy campaign season anyway with the presidential election, and decided to put it off a year. So they're going to spend the rest of this year as well collecting signatures to sort of trigger that process.
So they're going for a state-initiated statute, which is a two, like really kind of a three-step process. Mm-hmm. You collect the first batch of signatures, like 134,000, 135,000. You present your proposed law to the legislature. They can either amend it and pass it, or ignore it. And if they either amend or ignore it, then the group has a second chance to go back, get another fresh set of 135,000 signatures, and then it goes on the ballot. It's a pretty onerous and challenging process.
It is, but this is an issue that a 90% of Ohioans support that proposal. That sometimes can move the General Assembly when even a fellow Republican in the governor's office cannot.
There's a couple reasons why this group is doing an initiated statute rather than a constitutional amendment. If you do a constitutional amendment, you just gather, I think, more signatures and go straight to the ballot. Through this process, they say that when you are campaigning for a ballot issue, it's hard to campaign for something when the other side is saying, but sure, you want this, but do you really want to amend the Constitution? And so they don't have to fight that as much going through this process. And a lot of things, what we see through the ballot issue campaign season is that legislators will say, don't vote for this. Give us a chance to work on it first. Mm-hmm. And if the group gets to that point where they do have to put it on the ballot, they can argue, we did give the lawmakers a chance. They didn't do anything with it. That's why we're going to you. So there's a couple of reasons and arguments why they're going through this process as well, even though, like Laura said, it's a more onerous process.
You know, and when you look at Ohio history, there's just so many issues that were defined or decided by the voters because the legislature didn't act. You know, indexing the minimum wage to inflation, or passing
smoking bans,
the indoor smoking ban, the casino gambling, the Defense of Marriage Act. I mean, there's a whole. Well, actually, they did act on Defense of Marriage, and then they put it on the in the constitutional amendment as well. But payday lending caps
reforms,
that got passed and went up for a referendum, and the voters said yes. And of course, then they. That's a whole other story.
Well, even the prospect of petitions is, and I think some of those probably fit into this category too, the prospect of petitions being circulated, signatures being gathered, and the possibility of a vote on something the legislature really doesn't like has spurred them to do something they don't like as much, but addresses the issue. Even way back, campaign finance reform, mm-hmm. you know, Common Cause and various groups like that were circulating petitions, and the legislature said, yeah, let us drive this van for a while, and that's what we have today.
Which is, we are not sure how that'll work, but we will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, also with us, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I am your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch. Senate President Larry Obhoff has indicated that deregulation is going to be a top priority of 2020. This is something that's taking root in state houses across the country and at the national level. Mm-hmm. What's he talking about? Because regulations are usually put in place to protect us from one thing or another.
Well, this Senate President Obhoff, he's a Republican from Medina. He believes that Ohio has a disproportionate number of regulations.
Is it true? Do we know?
He cites a study.
There are studies that say that Ohio has more regulations in place for different occupational licenses than compared to other states. Compared to most states, Ohio is ranking near the bottom.
And, you know, some regulations are obviously perfectly rational, like, you know, regulations governing food temperature at restaurants, or that somebody who's going to cut your hair has to be trained, that paramedics and police officers need to have certification. But there's other regulations I'm sure that they can point to that are kind of irrational or outdated. And one of the kind of like dovetailing into that is an effort to either change, like modify some of the training and certification requirements for certain professional licensing, and also to add reciprocity to other states. So if you move in from Michigan or Indiana and you are already a licensed cosmetologist, should you have to go through, you know, hundreds of hours of training to get an Ohio license, or can you do a reciprocity?
And at this point, you do have to go through that hundreds of hours of training?
There's some reciprocity issues in place right now. So this would be more of a blanket thing, which is if you have the license in one place, if it requires more or equal training to what Ohio, then why not just allow it here as well? A lot of conservative groups find this to be a really big issue in Ohio. They see it as a barrier to employment, where a lot of these occupations are more of the pull yourself up by the bootstraps type of things where, hey, I want to do this or I want to do that. I want to make something of myself, so I'm going to go do it. Oh, in order to do this, I need to get a license. Well, how do I get a license? Oh, I need to do one, two, three, four dozens of things in order to qualify for that.
And so, if I want to move to Ohio, I'd have to do
it
all over
again. Yeah.
This is also a big issue for spouses of active duty military, particularly who, you know, their spouse will be assigned to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is, you know, the largest single site employer in Ohio with like 30,000 jobs. And, you know, the military families move a lot, and you move into Ohio and you have your license from some other state, and you know, you have to go through this big rigmarole. It's just pretty burdensome.
Yeah, so the other thing is there is a system in place right now that the legislature passed last year because they're so gung-ho about this, is to put up a review of these different regulations and licensure regulations that are in place. And I believe they're going to go through a third of the licensures over the course of the next
three years.
A board that's been created, a commission of lawmakers that's been created to review the process to see if there really are just too many regulations in place per licensure. So
seems like these things have been done before, and I feel like they never really go anywhere.
You're right. And the same thing was done with, I think, the tax break, the tax expenditures, which is a commission's been put into place to review something. But is there any action taken against it? So that's still in place. That's still something that's sort of in the works right now that they're working towards. I think the big question is, like Laura said, there are a lot of occupations that say, hold on. There's a reason why we have these regulations in place. One of the biggest industries to step up and testify against sort of the effort to roll these regulations back is civil engineers, who say, well, you need to have these certain requirements in place so you know how to build a bridge and fix a road. And the legislature would argue that, well, yeah, so we'll keep your industry as is, but maybe we'll loosen the regulations for embalmers and cosmetologists. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Two things. Senate President Obhoff has proposed this a couple years ago, after the study by George Mason University, which is very anti-regulation. Mm-hmm. The I think it's the Mercantor Center there.
That's right.
And frankly, anti-regulation is sort of one of the traditional planks of the Republican Party. So it's something that gains a sympathetic ear right out of the gate with a lot of those who now control the legislature. Interestingly enough, however, I know there have been more than one press conference, several press conferences, where the president has been asked, can you identify two or three, just as you said, Ann, you know, and
give me
Lord
one.
Knows, I mean, this should be easy puckins, right? I mean, if you say that, you know, we're so overburdened with thousands and thousands, can't you, you and I could go through the code and say, well, why is that there? But they are unable to do so. He has been unable to cite a single example. Now, Laura and Andy, you're over to State House more than I. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but
well, it seems like the easy pickings would begin with that George Mason University study. What does Ohio regulate that other states don't?
But see, that was more of a numeric study.
I was going to say
they never detailed.
We have a bazillion, and other states only had 3/4 of a bazillion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So therefore, Ohio bad.
Okay.
I mean, that was kind of, I'm sure I'm grossly oversimplifying it, of course, but I don't recall that anything specific was pointed out. And we go to fellow Republicans, Franco Rose, Secretary of State, John Husted before him. Okay, what do you think about this? For every new rule you make, you got to dump two. Especially like in the elections law, it's like they were stumped. Because what are you going to say? Okay, well, you no longer have to be a resident of Ohio to vote in Ohio or what? Again, I exaggerate a little bit. But, they, you know, honestly, they scratch their heads when it comes down to this practical level. The rhetoric sounds good. You know, I can stand up at a Rotary Club, whatever, you know, red tape and all that. Who's in favor of red tape and bureaucracy? It all sounds good. But, you know, like John Lennon said, we'd all love to see the plan.
Bill sponsor. When it comes to the occupational licensing, bill sponsors were a little hesitant to specifically name certain regulations or industries as well. They would say their argument was that that's because they didn't want to spotlight one or pick on one industry over another. Whether that just provides cover for them or not, we don't know. But that was part of the argument, is that they didn't want to unfairly name one industry and say, this is the one we're targeting. They're saying, as a whole, they want to look at the issue of overly regulating occupations.
As scintillating as it sounds, I will not be covering that commission to go through all of the regulations.
See, that would be something I would be into. I know.
Lots
of these rules and regulations, particularly the entry, you know, the portals to careers in any of these things, a lot of times it has been charged over the years that they erect these barriers to keep out new, you know, competition, to keep out more, CPAs, more cosmetologists, more this, more that, whatever it might be.
Well, and so, this must mean that you probably cover the Operations and Improvement Task Force.
Which one?
Under Governor Voinovich when he came in.
Well, yeah. I tried to get into
the bowels of state government.
What I did with that is I tried to find out who gave money to the Voinovich administration and how was that reflected in the appointments to that committee. So,
see how cynical she is.
Another
listeners.
Blue ribbon commission bites the dust.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I am. Yeah. There's a million of them. Sports gambling. There was a 2018 Supreme Court decision on that.
Yeah, actually, yep. It legalized it at the federal level. There's a number of states
have it in place. But
Ohio,
here we are, 2020.
Well, there's kind of a conflict between the House and the Senate on this, so it hasn't moved yet. But the House is backing a bill that would give the Ohio lottery oversight control, and the Senate thinks that it should be the purview of the Casino Control Commission.
Why can't they agree on this?
Well, the House and the Senate, you know, it's interesting because they're both, controlled by the Republicans, by men named Larry, but they don't seem to be on the same page on a number of things.
I think part of the argument might be that depending on which entity it's regulated through, it could maybe change the revenue a little bit of where the revenue's sent or where the money goes that is collected because of sports gambling.
Uh-huh.
Again, there may or may not be ego involved here, too, where somebody wants to control where it goes over another place.
But the longer this goes on,
the longer the
Bickersons keep talking about this, yeah, the longer it takes before Ohio can start cashing in at any level.
There are several,
when it comes to sports gambling.
Like you said, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that sports gambling was legal, several states jumped on that opportunity,
yeah,
legalized it. They are now experiencing
kaboom.
Yep, and so Ohio just hasn't gotten on it. And when the ruling came down, several lawmakers said it's time to go. It's time to get on this. Let's work on it now. And so we're just kind of in limbo right now. You know, you think about the Super Bowl coming up, where that could be a big opportunity for Ohio to get some money out of it if they do want to go down this road.
Well, by the way, it's not that people aren't gambling. It's just that Ohio's
not
getting any revenue from it.
That's right. So that's something that had a little bit of a momentum last year. There are bills in both committees that have received hearings, but then at this point, it's kind of fallen silent a little bit. So we don't really know where that momentum's going at this point.
I mean, big picture here, and you know, we're talking about this and the things we're going to talk about the rest of the show. 2020, and for certain, mostly the first half of 2020, is going to be a huge year for a lot of important topics because, as you well know, once it gets near Memorial Day, these guys, guess what? They're up for re-election. They are going to be mighty scarce in Columbus, which Columbus says, thank you, but all their districts say, oh, no, now you're in our hair,
now it's
running for re-election. And they may not come back until a lame duck session. Who knows?
Right.
And besides all this stuff, we're talking about, you know, charter school reform. We have the Cup Patterson school funding plan. I feel like every time I'm on your show, Ann, it's like a little bit of Groundhog Day.
Yes.
It's like, geez, are you guys actually going to pass something here on guns or school funding or any of this stuff? They're just kind of repetitive topics. The next 6 months will be very crucial whether any of this is going to happen in Ohio.
And then plus every year that goes by, we still haven't, the legislature still hasn't done anything to change unemployment compensation, which
right.
used to be a huge.
And we're coming on to a problem, some kind of setback mm-hmm. Economically, just given the tides, but haven't done anything. They learned nothing.
Right, where many agree that the fund is insolvent at this point, and that if we were to hit an economic downturn,
even close to what we hit in 2008,
then we would run out of money and then need to borrow from the feds and then pay back with interest. And so that's again, it's just another one of those issues where Daryl's already talking about the end of the year, where maybe at like lame duck of this year, we're going to be staying up late covering some of these things.
Oh, I know. And that's
you don't miss those on those off years, do you?
Seldom does anything good come out of those lame duck sessions. There's so much stuff.
One thing that will pass before Memorial Day is the capital budget. It's likely to be about two.
Because it has to by law.
It has to. It'll likely be about $2.6 billion. This is the budget that funds, you know, big ticket items, renovations on college campuses,
buildings, brick and
buildings,
mortar.
Right, for the most part. And then there's also a little pool kind of carved out within that, I think like roughly $150 million. And this is for the kind of the wish list of community projects. And the communities that kind of prioritize and lobby, you know, they're the ones that usually they'll get backing for a handful of projects in each community.
We will be back. This is our All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. That's Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Still with us as well, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. My guests, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Let's see. Is it easier to say what did get done in this past year? Did anything? I was thinking bills that did become law.
House Bill 6.
Mm-hmm. House Bill 6, right.
And the gas tax. In the transportation budget bill.
Heartbeat bill.
Heartbeat bill. Yeah. And the state budget.
And the state budget, which has to be done. Let's talk about House Bill 6 real quick, because that's got that's the plan to bail out two nuclear power plants and some coal plants in Ohio and in Indiana, a coal plant, coal burning power plant in Indiana. That always kind of gets me.
Hey, we're a generous people in Ohio.
We are a generous people. There is a challenge of the petition process. So there was an effort to get signatures and get it on the ballot. In the primary ballot, right?
For referendum.
For referendum.
For a referendum that would have ended up on November's.
November.
It would have been on November's. Yeah. Okay, I corrected on that. So they didn't make it. Mm-hmm. They didn't get enough signatures. They're saying that they needed roughly 34 days or so more. They weren't allowed to be even begin collecting signatures. They had a delay.
So they, under the Constitution, you get 90 days to collect signatures for a referendum. However,
from when the bill was passed,
from when the bill was signed into law.
Yeah. Yes.
Then what happens is that you still need to get pre-approvals from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General for the wording of the petition, et cetera. And that they argue that ate up like 34 of our 90 days.
Well, I'm surprised this kind of issue hasn't popped up in the past anyway, if that's the case, because there's often a lag time.
So Ed Sargis, the federal court judge who got the case, said this isn't really a question of federal law. It should really be decided by the Ohio Supreme Court. And he certified four or five questions to the Supreme Court. And then just, what was it, last week or the week before?
It was Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve.
December 24th.
Right. So the court said, yes, we'll go ahead and decide these questions.
Which is kind of a surprising thing. First of all, it happened so late in the year. The questions were sent over to the Ohio Supreme Court weeks and weeks ahead of that time. A couple of other things to keep in mind. I'm forgetting how many justices have to recuse themselves.
Three
have to recuse themselves because of involvements that their campaigns have had with First Energy Solutions.
Campaign contributions.
Campaign contributions and
And personnel.
And so this is going to be a really interesting case. So what they're doing is they're taking up what are called the certified questions that are sent over from a federal judge. Judge Sargis mentioned in his ruling that he found a lot of the actions that were in question to be very problematic and to issues that he thought should be investigated further, but that he wasn't the right venue for it. Just to recap, so the referendum group was out there collecting signatures. They said that they didn't have the full 90 days or what they thought could have been 75 days to get all the signatures. But then they also added that there were a lot of other factors in play that kind of blocked them from getting the signatures they needed, which was a tens of millions of dollars effort in stopping the people from getting those signatures through counter campaigning,
alleged intimidation,
mailers that were sent out there. So they said it was already an uphill battle, already didn't have enough the amount of days that they thought they should have had, and also fighting against this well-funded counter campaign.
Who appoints the substitute justices when?
I believe it's the Chief Justice.
I would say so too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is Maureen O'Connor.
Right.
Yeah, okay. But Andy's right. There was such a huge counter campaign, millions and
Massive.
Millions of dollars spent by, of dark money groups to both dissuade people from signing the referendum petitions, and then also to sway public opinion. And they also circulated like another it was like a petition just to show grassroots support for their side of things, but it held no. It wasn't presenting a constitutional amendment or a referendum.
It was very confusing, though, to a lot of people.
It was super confusing,
and it's not quite. And frankly, it's not quite as pure on the pro referendum side, the anti bailout side, because they also made mistakes during the process. Part of the reason the getting the proof of the language. Took so a little bit longer anyhow was they messed it up the first time around, as if memory serves. So, okay, some of that splashes on them as well. And does this, even if there's a dirty campaign against you, are your constitutional rights violated?
Well,
it's
going to
be a very
interesting
question.
Because there's a freedom of speech, free speech issue there. Logically, though, it seems to me that if you say you have 90 days to collect signatures after the laws after the bill is signed into law by the governor, but that's not true. That's flat out not true.
When should the clock start?
When does the clock start?
And should it sign?
Obviously doesn't start at that point, because no matter what, at that point, they still have to send the language, whatever it is, and no matter how perfected it might be.
But can you also make the argument, okay, yeah, we made the law that was 90 days, but we also approved all the laws that required the Attorney General to certify the language and Secretary of State mm-hmm. to certify the 1,000 signatures. We knew that. The legislature approved all of that, so...
The main question, mm-hmm. though, is the 90 days is in the Ohio Constitution. Mm-hmm. The pre-approval stuff is in law. So yeah. The question is, are those laws unconstitutional?
And these are laws that
conflict with the constitutional mm-hmm. mandate. Yeah.
And these were laws that were created long, long, long ago. So the constitutional part of a referendum was created in the state, was put into the state constitution, and then a few years later, Ohio revised law created a different process to play into that referendum. So these are laws that have been in place for decades, but this is the first time that a group has really challenged it at this level. So we're going back into sort of Ohio history where you got the Constitution that says 90 days. You've got Ohio law that can delay that process by 15
externally,
to 30 days.
Yeah.
So you know, where does the constitutional rights fall then?
It's kind of, I don't know, I find it interesting.
I think it's just another chapter in this long
saga. Meanwhile, back at the
ranch,
the bailout goes forward? Or now? Does it?
You know, so
yeah, the bailout
the true,
still goes forward.
When we say bailout and when we talk about the surcharges that people will see, the increased fees that they'll see on their electric bills, that will not start until next year anyway.
Anyway, right.
And so... these utility companies that are supposed to figure out all these electric security plans that really dictates what kind of charges a customer will see, that process is going to play out this year. The question is, if this issue is still lingering in court, what do the energy companies want to do? What do the power generating companies want to do? The company that owns the two nuclear power plants, do they see this as an issue going forward? Do they think that they're sort of threatened to lose the subsidies? And so do they keep the plants open? All of those are still question marks that are sort of just up in the air because we have this court case going on.
And as First Energy still comes out of bankruptcy, First Energy Solutions,
yeah.
under a new name.
Which is Energy Harbor is the new. So we'll keep saying First Energy Solutions, but it's
Energy Harbor.
Energy
and by the
Harbor.
Way, this was a bipartisan passed measure.
Nine Democrats voted for it, and several Republicans voted against it.
It was an intriguing coalition because a lot of the Democrats were concerned about the jobs that would be lost, in their home districts mm-hmm. in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It squeaked through, though. Remember, they had a plan to dispatch the state plane to Chicago
to pick up some lawmakers
who were in Chicago for some sort of a conference. They put the kibosh on that after we posted a story on it.
Right. The point of the issue being the state plane issue.
Right.
That's not.
And on the drive back from Chicago, they had to pass through a wind farm. I thought that was an interesting note that they made on the House floor.
All right. Something else that's happening this year that often affects Ohio is the 2020 presidential race.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that thing.
We are finally
the
year. Statisticians are already predicting things such as they are. President Trump is going to be at a campaign rally on Thursday in Toledo, I guess, despite these
foreign affairs.
But his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, will speak on his behalf at an event on Wednesday here in Columbus.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. It's parallel to what happened in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, that she came in sort of the day before for a rally across the state, and then the president was at another location. So it's almost, it's not the first time it's happened. It's just, I can't say why or anything, but.
The Trump family is wildly popular among their supporters. So seeing anybody, even if it's not the president himself, does rally support among certain people in Ohio. And so I think that sort of plays a role. Since July of last year, Trump's campaign in Ohio has been pretty steady in increasing staff and increasing rallies. When the president has a rally somewhere else, one of his official campaign rallies, not a presidential rally.
What's the difference?
Sorry, I just meant like when he has one of those big campaign rallies, his Make America Great Again rallies is what I was trying to say.
Okay.
In a place like Michigan or Florida, they'll still have watch parties going on in Ohio, and they get a pretty good attendance. And so they've been sort of straddling this line of doing the big tent campaign rally things while also working on their grassroots strategy as well. And I think that's kind of where the Laura Trump thing comes in, where if she comes in and meets supporters, that sort of rallies people here in Ohio while the president's going to make a trip to Toledo.
And, you know, it's going to be interesting. We talk about all this legislation and now a presidential campaign, and we haven't even mentioned one of the most critical facts of all is that Ohio is almost certainly going to lose net jobs for the year 2019 when the official numbers come out here in a few days or several days. Where's the legislation to look at that? Where is the we're right back to 2008. We're right back to basically the depths of the recession now. And to whatever side of the political aisle are you on, would it not be time to assess where we are and all that? Now, I give the governor credit. He's talking about, training, workforce development, things of that nature. For heaven's sakes, getting enough people can pass a drug test to get a job. The critics will say, well, look at the classified ads, or not classified ads anymore, but look at the one ads. There are plenty of jobs where the people, so making that match. But is it more than that? I mean, actually losing jobs in the context of what's going on, as you hear the president perhaps justifiably brag about across what's happening across the country in terms of jobs being created.
Which is part of a trend that started 4 years before he took office, but...
Right. But Ohio had been, gaining at least some jobs. So now we're on the negative. I mean, we're not at this point with the numbers today. We're not close to recession, for heaven's sake.
So what does that mean for the president then going forward? Is that something
he plans? I mean, I spoke to several of his campaign staff in Ohio and a Trump delegate, and they plan to make everything about the economy. And so if there is a downturn, if the numbers do start to dwindle, that's going to be a huge hit to their campaign strategy, because another part of their strategy is to sort of say, ignore the controversial statements, ignore the hearings and investigations, look at what he's actually doing for the economy.
Which is classic.
And if it's not going well, then it does change things.
But the thing is that the loss of jobs in Ohio, if that comes to fruition, it won't be part of his campaign narrative.
He'll
his campaign narrative will be about how unemployment is at record lows and that the stock market is doing well.
That your retirement fund is going up.
And frankly, I exchanged emails with the head of their Ohio campaign over the weekend, because we had written some things about what the job loss is going to be. Part of this depends on how you count. The Trump campaign posits that on Election Day is when we're going to start counting, because the instant Donald Trump was declared to be president, happy days were here again. So anything from that nanosecond onward gets credit to him, as opposed to the end of Obama's term till January 20th of 2017. I mean, here in Ohio, and this is how I explained to him, a lot of times when we do, it's such a dicey game giving credit to any one person anyhow, governor or president or whatever.
I agree.
But it's done rhetorically all the time.
Right.
When John Casey took over, he didn't want any numbers till he was 6 months in because they were bad. And, there's some truth to that. It's not like the governor takes over and all his or her new policies are enacted immediately.
In fact, often it's years later in reality.
There's a long tail to it.
There's a huge, yeah.
But if you're going to make that argument, let's at least be consistent. Dare I plead that at the end of our show?
We're out of time.
All righty.
Yeah, we ran out of time, you guys. So once again, Darrell Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Happy 2020. And
we'll be back at you. We'll talk about the resolution of some of this stuff. Just think, a year from now, many of these questions will be answered. We'll know who's going to be in the White House.
Wow. Just a year, and time flies when you're having fun. So Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter, thanks for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.